Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSwinney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. A disturbing and damning report has been released about sexual misconduct in the military. It finds there's a sexualized culture in our armed forces that is hostile to women and conducive to harassment and assault. To respond to the report, we're joined by Major General Chris Whitecross. The McLean's panel gives its take on misconduct in the military, as well as a new poll that shows a budget bump of support for the Conservatives and the surprising NDP strength in the final days of the Alberta election campaign. The trial for Senator Mike Duffy is on pause. That's due to the Crown and Defence debating the admissibility of a key piece of evidence. To get an update on the court case, I speak with Nick Kohler, who's covering the trial for McLean's. And Supreme Court Justice Marshall Rothstein is retiring from the bench this summer. The Prime Minister has had a tense relationship with the top court, so how will he handle this vacancy in the short time between the retirement and the fall election? We speak with political science professor Emmett McFarlane. For your politics and power, welcome to The Hill.
As to the findings of the report, I'll be very clear. They're disturbing. Disturbing to me, disturbing to the leaders within the Canadian Armed Forces, and I believe they'll be disturbing for the great majority of our members in uniform.
That's the Chief of Defence Staff, Tom Lawson, reacting to a new report which describes an underlying sexualized culture in the military which is hostile to women and LGBTQ members and conducive to more serious incidents of sexual harassment and assault. The report was prepared by former Supreme Court Justice Marie Deschamps, who was asked to conduct an external review after an investigative report that ran in McLean's and our French publication L'Actualité in May 2014. It revealed that sexual misconduct was still a major problem in the military, despite promises to change after a McLean's investigation from 1998 that also found serious issues with misconduct. And the misconduct highlighted in this latest report ranges from degrading comments, sexual jokes, discrimination, and unwanted sexual touching, to extreme cases of using sex to enforce power relationships, using sex to punish a member of a unit, and even date rape. In addition to the sexualized culture, the report is damning of the leadership, showing senior non-commissioned officers appear to have imposed a culture where no one speaks out and victims are deterred from making complaints. Victims say they didn't come forward because they feared repercussions, such as no career progression and retaliation from their peers and supervisors. But the military is responding to the report with an action plan.
Action is the operative word here. The Canadian Armed Forces must now take strong steps forward and initiate progressive change. For those in uniform, let me make clear to you that the problem lies not only with those who behave poorly or maliciously. The responsibility also rests with those who idly stand by and permit inappropriate behavior to persist, from jokes to harassment to assaults.
And that action plan only accepts in full 2 of the 10 recommendations made by the former Supreme Court judge. The other 8 are only accepted in principle, including the recommendation to create an independent body to handle future harassment claims. While the CDS is now promising change, he wasn't always speaking like this.
The most concerning of these findings is the existence of an underlying sexualized culture that, if unchecked, is conducive to sexual misconduct.
But back in May of last year, after the McLean's article was released, the Chief of Defence Staff defended the military by refuting our report.
I do not accept from any quarter the notion that sexual misconduct is simply part of our military culture.
A year later, and the tone is very different. To fully discuss the report and the military's response, I'm joined now on the phone by Major General Chris Whitecross. Back in May, the Chief of Defence Staff said to a House of Commons committee, "I do not accept from any quarter the notion that sexual misconduct is simply part of our military culture." That same month, I did an interview with Brigadier General Kevin Cotton, who told me that perceived form of culture does not exist in the Canadian forces, is not welcomed here, and is contrary to our basic values and ethics. On the fact of a sexualized, hostile culture, it was basically denied by the military from even just those quotes I gave you there. And this report says that was not the case at all. How did you guys get it so wrong?
Well, initially, the picture that we had had back in May 2014, like you mentioned, it showed that the retention rates for women was actually higher than that of men. That would imply that women were, you know, enjoying full careers in the Canadian Armed Forces. In addition to that, there was a survey done, and it showed that harassment was at an all-time low throughout the Canadian Armed Forces. And then you get the media articles from Maclean's and L'Actualité, which showed a completely different picture. So it was at that point where the CDS commissioned an external review, which is something completely unprecedented in our department, to really take a hard look internally within our system from somebody who comes from the outside, to take a real hard look at what is the condition today. So whereas we thought we were well down this road, in fact, reality is that we were not as far ahead as we thought we had been.
But with all due respect, I mean, that doesn't really jive, because these comments saying that they don't accept that there is this sexual misconduct culture in the military came after the exposure of the article.
None of the leaders of the Canadian Armed Forces accept that this can be allowed in our military. And for that reason alone, my job, the CDS has appointed me to address the report, to develop an action plan, and to make the rate of improvement far better than it was in the past, which is exactly what I'm doing.
But, okay, whether you have rules in place or not, it's the practice of those rules and how they're implemented that really matters, that actually makes a difference. The leadership had said, after Maclean's had this expose and L'Actualité, that they didn't believe there was a culture of misconduct. This report basically backs up a lot of the details that were in that initial report from Maclean's and L'Actualité, that there was this culture of suppression of these complaints that come forward. So how is it that the leadership then missed all of this?
So, I firmly believe that the Canadian Forces leadership does not tolerate and was not aware at the time that the situation was this bad. Having said that, my job is to take the report from Madame Deschamps and to implement the recommendations that she had brought forward, and that's exactly what I'm going to do.
The issue, though, was that they said confidently that there wasn't this culture even after the expose, and now we have this report, and now you're accepting it. So it seems, on the face of it, the words given yesterday that the military brass accept this culture is not what we were told 1 year ago. So I guess I'll ask you another question then. Why no independent body to investigate these claims? You accept the recommendation in principle, but you don't accept it fully. Why don't you accept it in full, that there should be an independent body to investigate any harassment claims in the future?
So the main reason for the center, the centralized center, is for the acceptance of the entire recommendation, is because we really need to understand better how the other centers are operating and how they've managed to create an environment of increased reporting and all that kind of stuff, so that we can bring that back and put it into a Canadian context. The Australians, the U.S., and their organization is headed by a two-star general in France and the rest. It is important that we understand how they operate, in addition to how different Canadian or domestic centers or academia and like-minded organizations operate, including the Vancouver Police and the Calgary Fire Department and even the Peel Police outside of Toronto. We need a quick fix or a sort of a knee-jerk solution may not be enduring. So whatever we put in place must meet the needs of the Canadian, every member of the Canadian Armed Forces, and it must be enduring.
No, I think everybody can agree with the fact that there shouldn't be just a quick fix without without properly setting all of the proper procedures in place. But there's no commitment for an independent investigative body for this. Does that mean that there's a possibility that you won't put in place an independent body?
The recommendations will go up through the chain, and there will no doubt be one of the strong recommendations will be for an independent center.
Part of the issue is that the report says that there is a serious lack of trust in the chain of command right now, to the point where victims express concern about not being believed, being stigmatized as weak, labeled as troublemakers, subjected to retaliation by peers and supervisors if they actually brought their complaints forward. How do you address that lack of confidence in the chain of command in the meantime?
I mean, obviously that we need a culture change. And these sorts of things, they take time. They take months and sometimes years. We've had some success in the past with PTSD, for example, in the 1990s, where for the very same reasons, people did not go to their chain of command. They did not approach sort of their chain of command for reasons of stigma and a number of other things. But things have changed. The perceptions have changed, and we're very much different than the 1990s in that space for mental health. We need to do the same thing here. We need to start the discussion from the bottom up and from the leadership level down. We have commitment from all the senior leadership of the Canadian Armed Forces that we must address this, that they must be engaged. And now, as you're aware, I mean, I'm doing visits to all the bases and wings across the country, and we're starting the discussion at every level of leadership, so that people understand not just the report and the action plan, but people understand at the heart of it, it's about treating our people better. It's about environments that are trust and dignity or in our people, which will provide for better Canadian Armed Forces in the future, because deployments and generating military forces really depends upon comrades in arms working side by side in a trustful environment.
But, I mean, a lot of those phrases and commitments to changing the culture of the military were exactly the commitments made by the military in 1998 when the first big expose from McLean's came out about this problem in the military. And 16 years later, a report from McLean's again showed that not a lot had changed. Women were still having issues with frequent use of swear words, degrading expressions that reference women's bodies, sexual jokes, innuendos, discriminatory comments, and also that senior NCOs are responsible for imposing a culture where no one speaks up and which functions deter victims from reporting sexual misconduct. We heard a lot of the same commitments in 1998. In 2015, we're hearing these commitments again, but nothing was done back then. So how can women in the military trust the military to actually follow through on that?
Well, I think there's three big differences between today and 1998. The first off is there's an organization whose entire focus is on sexual misconduct and addressing the issue. That's never happened before. And these people, I have men and women, military and civilian, in my team, and every single one of them wants to be there and wants to make a change. Second one is, so it's sustainable, but the second one is everything we do is going to be measured. We haven't done that either. And in the measurement, we're going to monitor them. Everything must be, every measure must be able to be monitored. And then we're going to report back. And we're going to report back quarterly, not just to the men and women of the military and the leadership, but to our external stakeholders as well. And then the third thing is leading that team, having the honor of leading that team is I'm very passionate and I want to make a change. And so does every member of my team. And unfortunately, I only have time for one more question.
If one more question, I'll do a sort of double one. One, why has no one been fired for this, given the issues that were popped up, and why no blanket apology to the victims who had their complaints suppressed, according to this report. And the question about firing, I'll refer back to that interview I did with Brigadier General Kevin Cotton. When asked about any possible cover-ups from senior supervisors, he had said that's a failure of leadership, and I'm quoting here, "We do not take that lightly, and we would relieve someone of command, and they would be subject to whatever punishment is deemed fit in the case where somebody has failed in terms of leadership." This report highlights a series of failures of leadership. So why has no one been fired for this? And there was no blanket apology for victims, and I'm just wondering if you could address why there's no, blanket apology.
Okay, in the first case, we do address people that have done things wrong. The report itself is completely unanimous. Madame Nichon made it very clear that there are no names, there are no locations, there's no timings, there's nothing. So in terms of that report, there is absolutely no ability. But we are encouraging anybody that came forward in the report to speak to Madame Deschamps that wants to speak to us and get some support to come forward. And in terms of apologizing, we do. And in individual cases come up where someone has been wronged, we step up and we do apologize. And the example in point is Master Corporal Raymond. And people are being relieved of command. A very senior officer was taken away from deployment a couple of years ago, and then there was a commanding officer in the Quebec region who was relieved of command very quickly after incident of sexual misconduct.
But on the apology issue, I mean, women who don't trust the system can't come forward, so they won't get an apology unless they come forward?
On individual basis, if people are found to be wronged, we step up.
That was Major General Chris Whitecross discussing sexual misconduct in the military. Still to come on the show, we have the McLean's panel. We find out why the trial for Senator Mike Duffy is on pause, and we hear about how the Prime Minister may handle the retirement of another Supreme Court judge. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Coming up on the show, we take a look at why the trial for Senator Mike Duffy was put on hold, we discuss the latest vacancy in the Supreme Court, and we speak with the artist who sculpted a new statue of John McCrae. But first, it's now time for the McLean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined by Paul Wells, the political editor for McLean's, and John Geddes, the McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief. Thanks very much for joining me, guys. All right, we're going to start off in talking about this, the external review from a former Supreme Court justice on sexual misconduct in the military. It's 89 pages long and quite damning, quite disturbing, actually, some of the stuff that the Supreme Court justice found after interviewing a lot of people in the military. I guess just first impressions. You watched the news conference. You heard everything that was in the report. How do you think the military came off in all of this, Paul?
It's John's story more than it is mine. First of all, this is the sort of thing that we are hearing happens in militaries around the world. There's a culture of there's a macho culture that is defensive and doesn't really push back against ordinary inquiry, and we're seeing the results of that here. The main recommendation out of the report is this notion there should be an external body for looking into complaints that is outside the normal chain of command, and that's a model that has been taken precisely from militaries around the world, because this is something that's been going on. I mean, McLean's has been reporting it since stories like this since long before I was at McLean's, and so we see that these are sort of entrenched attitudes and entrenched problems that are going to be hard to root out.
And John, you were with McLean's in that initial 1998
report. Yes, I'm very old, Cormac. Is that your point? Is that what you're getting at? Yes, I was there in 98. We had cover stories. I was not the main investigative journalist behind the cover stories. Those were people, really good journalists, who are no longer with us. Stephanie Nolan was one of them. But I did do some of the institutional follow-up on it, talked to General Barry, who was the Chief of Defense Staff at that time. And I can tell you that at that time, one of the key issues they were grappling with was this chain of command issue. How do you deal with complaints about sexual misconduct of various kinds when the people who might be making the complaints don't really trust the chain of command to handle them fairly and fully? You know, that they're worried about various things happening, it hurting their careers, it coming back on them personally. So what did we hear yesterday? We heard General Lawson, the current chief of defense staff, saying the chain of command has the best interests of its members, of its rank and file members at heart. That's what the chain of command is worried about. People need not worry. If they bring their complaints into the chain of command, they will be dealt with properly. He's repeated that point confidently more than once. So there's a big dislocate between what he's saying and what Justice Deschamps' report said. So it's a funny thing, Cormac. Even if Lawson is right, like even if he's right that chain of command deals very well with these kind of complaints, the truth is that the review found that rank and file soldiers don't believe that. And that's what really matters. People are not going to bring complaints into a system that they don't trust, even if they're wrong. I'm not saying they are wrong, but even if they're wrong, it doesn't matter. What they think is what matters. They don't think it works, so they're not going to bring the complaints. That's why the review called for a separate agency or a separate body to be set up to handle this. And really, I think unless that happens, this whole process is just going to repeat itself down the line somewhere else.
All right, now let's talk a little bit about polls. The Conservatives have a little bit of a budget bump. They're now well ahead of the Liberals. John, what's your take on this?
I think the Conservatives are pretty good at selling budgets. Now, I think there's more behind these poll numbers than budget bumps, but I think the Conservatives have proven that they're pretty good at selling budget measures. Let me link the polling bump from this budget to something else we had this week. The Auditor General's report comes out, and the Auditor General notes that, gee, the Finance Department doesn't really bother to show whether or not a whole suite of boutique tax cuts are really doing anything or not. And the AG correctly or you know, properly for his role says they should really look to see whether these tax measures are having the effect they're supposed to have. The effect they're supposed to have is reminding people that the Conservatives have cut their taxes in various ways. That's the effect. That's why we have a fitness tax credit, a tax credit for transit ridership. I don't think it's overly cynical to say the purpose of these tax cuts is not actually to change people's behavior, it's to change their attitudes towards Ottawa. So they're reminded at various points of contact with the federal government that, oh yeah, I got a tax cut, I'm getting a tax credit, I have a tax deduction. That's the point of it all. So I just mentioned this by way of saying, like, it shouldn't be surprising to us that the Conservatives are getting a bounce of the budget because they're good at selling budget members. They craft them for political impact, and that's what they get out of them. Paul?
The NDP and Liberals hit hard on the comment that Joe Oliver made that said, the deficit implications of the TFSAs can be addressed by Stephen Harper's granddaughter. That's really swell, but this is a budget about billions of dollars shuffling back and forth. And what every Conservative MP has been putting out on their Twitter account, on their home webpage and so on is, come to this meeting so you can be sure to get your money out of this budget.
Right.
And so if I'm a distracted nonpartisan citizen at home, I'm like, well, the Conservatives and the NDP, or the Liberals and the NDP are very upset about a grammatical fillip of something that the finance minister said. And my MP has a meeting where I can go and get money because I got kids. I like this one, and it's a reminder that the games that excite us here in Ottawa are not the preoccupation of people back home. And this election was always going to be a referendum on, do you want less government or do you want more government? And the Conservatives are not messing around when they propose less government.
And on your note about the preoccupation of people in Ottawa compared to the rest of the country, are you surprised or not surprised to see this bump, even though we had the Duffy trial going on at the same time and a lot of what otherwise could be seen as negative press for the Conservatives in this scandal?
Not super surprised. In 2000, I was a reporter with the National Post, which was really feeling its oats on the Shawinigate story. And Jean Chrétien was running for re-election. And we had a Shawinigate story just about every day on the front page of the National Post, chasing the Prime Minister across the country. We had a National Post reporter asking the Prime Minister about that stuff day after day, and at the end of it, he won with a bigger majority. People notice these scandals, and they take them seriously. But you need a sustained barrage of horrible news on these fronts for week after week, as with Gomery and sponsorship, for it to really wear on a government's ability to get its message out.
Are you surprised at all, John?
I'm a little surprised, I have to be honest. I thought we'd be in the writ period before we start to see these kinds of movements. So I'd be lying if I said I saw something like this coming.
And then finally, we'll look at the provinces and specifically Alberta with its election. I mean, there's also an election in PEI, but it seems like the attention is on Alberta right now because polls are showing possibly an NDP government. Paul, you've been tracking this. You were out there. Yes, exactly. You were wandering around Alberta for a little while talking to people. What's your take on this in the final days as we hit this home stretch of the Alberta election?
The Conservatives are taking care not to look panicked. I mean, Jim Prentice has been running a pretty robust campaign schedule. He had a radio interview that people said, boy, listen to that radio interview, he sounds awful. And I listened to it and he sounded pretty good. So, but the polls are not looking great and they're looking different from 2012. In 2012, Wild Rose had about an 8-point advantage over the Conservatives for the 2 weeks before the election, and then it collapsed in the last little bit. But Wild Rose's lead was not growing and it was about 8 points. The NDP is now about 20 points ahead of Wild Rose and the Conservatives, and they've been gaining a couple points a day for the last little while. I mean, people are only coming around to the notion that they're going to vote NDP. This isn't something that they've had for a while, and then they're getting cold feet. I think it's possible to imagine the NDP advantage growing over this final weekend.
Paul, it's that old axiom you hear people say that it's the trends in polls that are worth watching rather than the snapshot. I think that's sort of what you're saying. That is so interesting. I can barely get my head around those numbers, like 20 points. Wow.
It's big. And also, Rachel Notley canceled an interview with a conservative radio station in Calgary, and they had a bit of a Twitter spat about it last night, but it shows to me what a lot of front runners end up doing, just pulling back on media interviews to make sure they don't screw up in that final home stretch when the numbers look good like that.
So. Until
now, Notley's been crazy accessible. When I was out there, I went to one of her events and her press secretary said, "You want to have lunch with her?" Okay, you know, but it's hardly unprecedented for a front runner to batten down the hatches in the stretch.
All right, thanks very much, guys. I really appreciate your thoughts today. McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes, McLean's political editor Paul Wells, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
On Wednesday, the trial for suspended Senator Mike Duffy was put on hold because the defense and the Crown began a debate about the admissibility of evidence. The trial has been dragging on, and this is yet another delay in the court case. To break down why there is a delay and what's been going on this week in the trial for the senator, I'm joined by Nick Kohler, who's covering the case for McLean's Gavel to Gavel.
Well, it was the first thing that happened on Wednesday morning. It followed a Tuesday afternoon of some really, I would say hostile cross-examination on the part of Donald Bain, who is Mike Duffy's lawyer. And he was questioning, if not to say interrogating, Nicole Prue, who is the former head of finance at the Senate of Canada, and really had her finger on the pulse of, you know, what money was going in and out of that institution. Now, Bain sees her as somebody who is biased, somebody who has already made her mind up in terms of who she's siding with. She's cooperated with the Crown and with the RCMP investigation that led to the charges against Duffy. And so he was moving into territory that has come up again and again. It has to do with an internal Senate report that looks at an Ernst & Young audit of, I think, specifically travel expenses, but all kinds of the rules and regulations surrounding how money is spent by senators. The Ernst & Young audit and the report that came after it out of the Senate seems to suggest that the Senate was aware of how hazy, perhaps, how vague, how difficult to follow the rules on this stuff actually were. And this is playing right into Donald Bain's argument, which is that Duffy didn't know how to follow the rules because there were essentially no rules. Now, the Crown jumped up and said, we can't go there because They call the report hearsay or opinion. It's kind of abstruse legal chit-chat. But what it comes down to is the Crown doesn't want this included as evidence. Why? Because it is opinion or it is hearsay. It's not coming from any horse's mouth. Bain says, yes, it is, that this is a table document and therefore a public document in the Senate. Why shouldn't it be, fair game? And so the judge, recognizing this as something that has arisen over and over again, said, I thought I was going to be able to handle this. You guys are making an issue out of it. So therefore, we're going to have a voir dire. And what is a voir dire? A voir dire is essentially a trial within a trial, a mini trial to determine whether or not they're going to permit this to they're going to permit this as evidence. And that's going to happen on Monday. And he said, look, to the Crown, you're going to have the rest of the week to prepare for this. That means that Nicole Proulx, whose cross-examination was almost over, but who is really, getting a pummeling from Bain, isn't going to come back till June. And this week, starting on Monday, there's going to be the voir dire. It's probably going to take one day. And then there's going to be some fascinating, we hope, testimony on the part of Gerald Donohue, who is this kind of mysterious figure we've heard so much about. We've seen his son, Matthew Donohue, in the witness box. And that testimony is going to have to do with two companies that Gerald Donohue was involved in. That's Maple Ridge Media Incorporated and Ottawa ICF, which was a construction company. And it was through these companies that the Crown alleges Duffy was funneling these weird payments, these checks paying for makeup jobs, paying for photographs to give a volunteer $500. And all of this was outside of Senate oversight, and it is one plank of the Crown's case against Duffy. And so this is going to be an interesting glimpse into that component of this case.
That was Nick Kohler with McLean's, who's covering the trial for suspended Senator Mike Duffy. Still to come, what will the Prime Minister do after the retirement of another Supreme Court justice? And we speak with the artist who sculpted a new bronze statue of Dr. John McCrae, the man who wrote In Flanders Fields. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Among the most intriguing stories of the past few years in Ottawa is the ongoing tension between the Harper government and the Supreme Court of Canada. That makes the retirement of Justice Marshall Rothstein, who is stepping down from the top court this summer, an intriguing moment. How will Prime Minister Stephen Harper manage the delicate business of replacing Rothstein in the brief time between his exit from the court and the fall election campaign? For his insights into this situation, we turn to Emmett McFarlane, a McLean's online contributor, a University of Waterloo political science professor, and the author of the book Governing from the Bench, which looks at the Supreme Court's influence on politics and policy. McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes spoke with McFarlane and started out by asking him to remind us how this whole subject of appointments to the court became such a politically charged issue.
Sure. The unprecedented situation was really the controversy over the failed appointment of Mark Nadon to the Supreme Court. This was something that resulted in a reference case to the court itself to determine what the eligibility requirement is for judges from Quebec. In that particular case, the Supreme Court actually ruled that that Mark Nadon as a federal court judge wasn't eligible for a Quebec seat on the court. And as a result of that failed appointment, and in addition, the court telling the government that Parliament by itself could not amend the eligibility criteria in the Supreme Court Act, we've actually seen the government pull back from fairly modest reforms to the overall process to appoint Supreme Court justices.
They had kind of opened the process up a little bit, the Harper government, right, and given it a bit more of a public dimension.
Yeah, so beginning in 2006, in the first year of the government's mandate, and with its first appointment of Marshall Rothstein, we actually saw a public interview of an appointee. It's not a nominee because there was no confirmation process that was required. But Marshall Rothstein appeared before a committee of parliamentarians, not a formal committee of parliament, though, to answer questions about his own background, his view on the role of a Supreme Court judge and of the court itself. And it was seen as, at least hopefully, an edification for the Canadian public and even for the MPs themselves, and shining a little bit of light on what has been historically an utterly opaque process.
Can you leap forward now to where we are now? We're going to have the resignation of Justice Rothstein is coming up. Where are we now with how will that vacancy be filled, and how does the old process now, is any of it surviving into this era? How will this, you know, where are we moving towards?
It seems as though in the aftermath of the Mark Nadon controversy that the government had decided to simply do away with all of the new elements of the process.
We're not really announcing that, eh? They just haven't said that it's going to go on that way again.
No, and indeed with the most recent appointment, we did not see a public interview of the appointee. And so it seems as if what will happen is the regular longstanding tradition of behind-the-scenes consultations, the Canadian Bar Association, the Chief Justice herself, in spite of a bit of a public spat following the Nadon affair, I would expect her to still be consulted about the needs of the court, what legal area might a new
what kind of judge
fill.
Would work.
Exactly. And then an announcement. What's interesting, of course, is that we have a very short time between Rothstein's official retirement at the end of August and the presumable election
October 19th is the official deadline for our official day for the election, so the campaign would start in September sometime.
And he would the Prime Minister, that is, would have to make the appointment before the campaign started, which may be a week or two of a window here.
Between the formal resignation of the Justice Rossi, who's leaving, and the writ drop sometime in mid-September, let's presume.
Assuming the writ drops for six-week campaign.
So how can you do a consultation in that time, do you think?
Well, I suppose it's possible. I imagine they might have to do some consulting before the official retirement date. And to be honest, given that most of Harper's appointments to the court have actually taken months, not days or weeks, I am not sure whether or not the legal community would frown on this process getting going before his formal retirement date. Maybe there won't be a problem with that, but I would be surprised certainly to see him not try to make the appointment before the election.
Yeah, it's a nice thing about being Prime Minister, being able to appoint these judges to give up that last kick it can before an election. Mm-hmm. It seems like where are we left in all this? I mean, I doubt very many of our listeners are that concerned about the appointment process, but people who worry about the Supreme Court and watch it are very interested. Is it possible that this whole schmozzle over Nadon, the aftermath, the kind of disintegration of the process that had come into place, that this is a, I mean, this will sound crazy, but is this an opportunity of some sort? I mean, I wonder if this is a time when, after an election, a new government could look afresh at the process, when even if the Conservatives are reelected, they might feel that they've had a kind of a breather here and try to reinstitute or rethink some of the processes. Is that too upbeat a way of thinking about it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess there's several different ways to look at this. Yeah. One component of the Nadon controversy was there was a view from some corners that this was an attempt by Harper to appoint more of an ideological ally to the bench, and that indeed we should scrutinize the Prime Minister's appointments for that reason. And I think it is clear that who makes an appointment can matter, and who sits on the court matters. Yeah. It makes a difference. These nine people, frequently enough, will split 5-4 over a fundamental issue of public policy or moral importance to Canadians. Now, I don't think we have a tradition of blatantly ideological appointing to the court, but that's not the same as saying there aren't politics involved. Stephen Harper has picked eminently qualified people, but a particular brand of justice to the Supreme Court. He's not picking...
Well, as you'd expect, right?
Indeed. But he's not picking a Rosalia Bella.
Sure.
He is picking people who are generally moderate. There aren't really a lot of conservative judges to appoint in Canada, but he's certainly picking people he believes to be at least sensible and relatively deferential to the will of Parliament. And... you know, in his view and in the view of any political leadership of any stripe, It's in his interest to make the appointment when the opportunity arises and not waste one prior to an election.
Could I try to pin you down on an opinion? Do you think that if it turns out there has to be a rushed process around this appointment, if you can't really get the consultation process going in earnest until at or around the time that the outgoing judge is leaving and that he only has a couple of weeks to an election, if he tried to rush it in that period, do you think that would be wrong, Emmett? Would that be an irresponsible thing to do, or do you think it's possible it could be done in a responsible way in that hasty time frame?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't want to be procedurally naive because I suspect the PMO already has a bit of a shortlist developed of prairie judges. And it's going to be, a lot of people think it'll actually be a Saskatchewan judge.
It was a Manitoba judge. Is he Rossing from Manitoba?
Yes.
He's Manitoba.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah,
so. And I don't think we've had a judge from Saskatchewan on the court since the early 70s.
Right.
I think Emmett Hall was the last.
Really? I didn't know that.
Saskatchewan judge. And so there are a lot of people in the legal community who I think are of the opinion that it's Saskatchewan's turn.
Yeah.
And it would almost be irresponsible for the PMO, or at least the justice, the Minister of Justice, whoever is really in charge behind the scenes, to not have some names already in mind.
Right.
And in light of that practical reality, is it really irresponsible for them to kind of get the appointment
in? Maybe it could go quickly and still be done properly.
Yeah, I might be a little generous, more generous than some people on that score.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with Supreme Court watcher and University of Waterloo political science professor Emmett McFarlane. This coming Monday, a statue of Dr. John McCrae, the soldier physician who wrote In Flanders Fields, will be unveiled in Ottawa. The date is important. McCrae wrote the famous 15-line poem 100 years ago on May 3, 1915. He wrote it near the front lines in Belgium during World War I after spending 10 grueling days in surgery coping with the wounded. The larger-than-life bronze statue of McCrae that's being unveiled is the work of Ruth Abernethy. McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes spoke with the artist and asked her to describe the moment she attempts to capture in her depiction of John McCrae.
But the moment of McCrae's writing of the poem, a very dear friend had been literally blown to bits and they had done
the day before, right?
Yeah. So he was, I think, in my view, McCrae is coming to terms. He is trying to find his own way through the madness of warfare. And just wanted to clarify his thoughts that if this friend hadn't died in vain, then the rest of them just had to buck up and get on with it.
Now, the statue being unveiled in Ottawa on Monday will be a little east of Parliament Hill at the National Artillery Memorial on Sussex Drive. Another casting of Abernethy's bronze is slated to be installed later this summer in Guelph, McCrae's hometown. Well, that's it for this week's episode. For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.